So we'll be in Matthew 26. Turn there. We're looking at the next, I think the almost the last passage in the chapter. Not going all the way through Peter's denial. So we'll be looking at verses 57 to 68. We began this section starting in the beginning of verse 26 in Matthew's Gospel by noting that Jesus had now finished speaking to Israel and he was now going to be delivered up to be crucified. That is how chapter 26 begins. And now we've kind of walked through each of the events that are leading up to his crucifixion. We've seen his burial. We've seen the Last Supper. We've seen his prayer in Gethsemane. And now we see him before the Sanhedrin, before the Jewish ruling council. This is his official trial, however short it may be. And of course, Pilate is the one who has to give that ultimate condemnation. He's the one who has to issue the death penalty, but we're not going to get there until the next chapter. So this is how Jesus is delivered up. He officially appears before the Sanhedrin, and then he appears before Pilate, the Roman governor of Israel, and then he ultimately shows up in Golgotha, where he appears before the holy God, bearing the sins of his people. So three judges, three judgments, and it is ultimately resulting in his death. But of course, that's not the end of the story. We've seen throughout this that what is happening to him has been what the scriptures have said would happen. So from the very beginning, he is making it clear that this is what the scriptures have said. This is what the prophets have spoken about. And he's made that point repeatedly to show us that even though he doesn't appear to be in control of the situation, he really is the one who is in control of the situation. Though all of these things are happening to him, he is the one who is laying down his life for the sheep. He is the one who is giving himself, like he gave the bread to the disciples during the Last Supper. He is the one who is pouring out his blood to establish the new covenant. But it does appear that things are out of his control, and that's why you see those references so frequently in this about him being delivered up. He is being handed over, he is being betrayed, and he is being delivered over to the Sanhedrin, delivered up to Pilate, and delivered up to be crucified. So all of this is in accordance with the scriptures. And Jesus is making that very, very clear. But today what we'll see is that he stands trial. His people have put him on trial, have ultimately charged him, and will at the end of this condemn him to die for blasphemy. So let's read through the passage and then we'll pick up in verse 57. So then those who had seized Jesus led him to Caiaphas, the high priest, where the scribes and the elders had gathered. And Peter was following him at a distance, as far as the courtyard of the high priest. And going inside, he sat with the guards to see the end. And now the chief priests and the whole council were seeking false testimony against Jesus, that they might put him to death. But they found none, though many false witnesses came forward. At last, two came forward and said, "This man said, 'I am able to destroy the temple of God and to rebuild it in 3 days.'" And the high priest stood up and said, "Have you no answer to make? What is it that these men testify against you?" But Jesus remained silent. And the high priest said to him, "I adjure you, by the living God, tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God." And Jesus said to him, "You have said so. But I tell you, from now on, you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of power and coming on the clouds of heaven." And then the high priest tore his robes and said, "He has uttered blasphemy. What further witnesses do we need? You have now heard his blasphemy. What is your judgment?" And they answered, "He deserves death." And then they spit in his face and struck him. And some slapped him, saying, "Prophesy to us, you Christ. Who is it that struck you?" So we pick right up where we left off last week. So So we were in the Garden of Gethsemane. Jesus rouses his disciples from their slumber as his betrayer and the crowds of armed soldiers come to arrest him. Jesus resists the temptation to respond in violence. He rebuked his one disciple who chose to do so. And he also rebuked the crowds for coming to him in the middle of the night with swords and sticks. They had plenty of opportunities to seize him in public, but now they seize him in the middle of the night. And this all happens so that the scriptures would be fulfilled. Repeating that twice in the previous section. And of course, at the end of that section, the disciples run away. The crowd, however, is on a mission. They bring Jesus immediately to Caiaphas, the high priest. And now there is this formal gathering of these leaders, these political, religious leaders, who together make up the Jewish ruling council, the Sanhedrin, which was consisted of at least, I think, 70 members, maybe 71, including the high priest. And they were charged, in a similar way to our courts, they were charged to pronounce judgments. That was their responsibility. They were here to decide and determine cases, evaluate and listen to witnesses, cross-examine them, and ultimately make decisions, make judgments. This is why they existed. So this was the plan for the crowds, though, and you have to recognize that it's odd for this to take place in the middle of the night. But we know that this is how their plan is coming to fruition. This is ultimately what they want to see happen. And Judas has provided them with the opportunity for it to happen. He has provided for them the timing and the place where Jesus was going to be, the time when he could be betrayed, the time when he could be seized, when he was most vulnerable. And he had led them there where they had seized him when Jesus had been betrayed into the hands of sinners. So all of this is happening, even though we're taking, you know, a chunk at a time every week, all of this is happening rather quickly. You know, it's been only a few hours before Jesus has sat down and had that Last Supper with his disciples. So immediately now we're thinking, okay, he's on trial, and how quickly is this trial going to go? There's no time to prepare. There's no time to prepare a defense. It's just Jesus against his false witnesses. So all of this happens very rapidly, and this has all been the plan from the very beginning of the chapter, and probably even prior to that. Last time we see these leaders gathering together was in the beginning of chapter 26. When they gathered together, they assembled themselves, and they had planned and schemed to come up with a way to arrest Jesus and kill him. We see that in the very beginning of chapter 26. The chief priests and the elders of the people gathered in the palace of the high priest, whose name was Caiaphas, and plotted together in order to arrest Jesus by stealth and kill him. So we can see now that their plan has come to fruition, right? These wicked, rebellious leaders are accomplishing their goals. We know ultimately, though, that it's not their planning that has determined it. God is the one who is writing the script, and they are merely following his orders. Interesting here, too, that Matthew teases us a little bit in verse 58. Now, I don't know if you noticed that when we read, but verse 58 is kind of a little teaser for what is to come. Peter was following him at a distance as far as the courtyard of the high priest, and going inside, he sat with the guards to see the end. So we know that Jesus' words have been fulfilled when he told the disciples that the shepherd would be struck and that all of the sheep would scatter. When he is arrested, he tells us in the end of verse 56 that the disciples flee. They run away. Now, we don't know exactly what they're thinking, but this was the one thing they said that they would not do when Jesus was arrested. There's no way we're going to abandon you. There's no way we're going to leave. And yet, of course, that is what happens. Maybe they are shocked by this large crowd that comes to Jesus with swords and clubs, and maybe they are simply shocked that Jesus was actually arrested. Maybe they were scared by the crowds. Maybe they were shocked by Jesus' lack of violent response or retaliation or defense. Regardless, they run away. But Peter apparently didn't run too far. Or maybe he ran far enough to notice that nobody was following him anymore. So he stops running, and at some point he turns around and decides to follow the crowds. He's still keeping an eye on Jesus. So he ran away, but he came back, and now he's following the crowds as they lead Jesus from the garden to the eastern entrance, the wall of the Temple Mount, to the palace of the high priest. He goes so far as to actually enter into the courtyard of the high priest and sit down with the guards, which is a very interesting approach. So we know ultimately what is going to happen with Peter. And I think this kind of sets us up for what's going to happen at the end of the chapter. Jesus had predicted not only that the disciples would scatter, that they would flee, but that Peter himself would deny him, and that he would deny him three times. And of course, that is what the next section is about. It's about Peter's denial. So in a way, 58 teases us as we look forward to Jesus' words coming true, to his denial, to Peter's denial. There's also probably something else going on too, which we'll refer to later. It is somewhat ominous when we read verse 58. We're not only anticipating Peter's denial, right? We know that Jesus' words have to come true. He predicted it would. Of course, we're familiar with the story, so we know what happens. But notice how he phrases it in 58. Peter was following him at a distance as far as the courtyard of the high priest. Going inside, he sat with the guards to see the end. Peter wants to know what is going to happen to Jesus. Where is this all headed? Where is this arrest going to lead? What will be the end of the matter? What is going to happen to Jesus? And we must not just imagine that Peter here is simply curious. You know, wow, this is strange. These soldiers arresting this rabbi in the middle of the night. He's not just interested in seeing what the outcome is going to be. Peter is most likely distraught, maybe feeling a little bit shamed for being rebuked for wielding his sword against the soldiers or the servant of the high priest. Maybe he's worried about Jesus. Maybe he's guilty, a little chastised. Maybe he's simply confused. But he's at least interested enough to follow at a distance and to see what the end is going to be. So we still see an element of loyalty to Peter, even though that's simply going to be erased here in the next section. But he's curious enough and he's determined enough to see what is going to happen to Jesus. It's not like he simply runs away and goes home and never thinks about this night again. No, he follows. He's determined to see the end. So we're going to set Peter to the side. Pick him up in a moment, but we'll set most of his story to the side until next week. And now we want to pick back up with Jesus and his accusers. So Jesus has been brought now before the whole Sanhedrin, and this is where the process of a formal trial begins. So the Sanhedrin would have included leaders from all of the religious and political groups, sects. And they probably would have included the Sadducees, obviously the scribes and the chief priests are mentioned here. The elders of the people are mentioned. The high priest is mentioned. I don't know if the Pharisees officially had a role in the Sanhedrin or not, but it's possible that they were there. All of the people that had been irritated by Jesus from the get-go, from the very beginning, even before he even arrived up, the people that John the Baptist had irritated with his preaching and with his practices, right? The people that he calls to repentance. So they now have their opportunity. This is the moment that they've been waiting for. From the very beginning, ever since Jesus started challenging the traditions, ever since the crowd had flocked to him to listen to his teaching, ever since he had called them to repentance, ever since he healed people on the Sabbath, they had wanted this moment to happen. And now they have their opportunity. They have this golden opportunity to condemn Jesus to death. So Jesus, at this point in his ministry, up until this point, I should say, he has been very skilled at resisting all of their attacks and even schooling them in issues related to the law. Remember just the previous chapters when he is questioned in the temple precincts, when he is questioned time and time again by these religious groups over issues related to eschatology and to the law, to politics, all of these different things, Jesus has responded very skillfully. He has put them to shame. He has silenced his accusers. He's even asked his own questions that they cannot possibly answer. So they've always been one-upped by Jesus from the very beginning. And now Jesus stands trial before them, and in response to their accusations, he is silent, which is an astonishing thing in itself. So they have Jesus right where they want him, on trial before the official ruling body. This is not just some group off in the woods. This is their official court. And all they need to do is find some sort of evidence that would satisfy their standard of justice so that they could condemn him. So verses 59 to 60 describe their attempt to find Jesus guilty of something, of anything that could possibly warrant his death. Now, it's somewhat humorous if it wasn't so tragic, but this is how Matthew describes it. The chief priests and the whole council were seeking false testimony against Jesus that they might put him to death. But they found none, though many witnesses came forward. Now, think about this for a second. They were seeking false testimony. That is what they were seeking. So they brought in all of the known liars, the pathological liars, all of those who have a reputation for maybe exaggerating their stories. So they went to the local bar and they found the guys who were there telling their stories about the monster bucks and their giant fish that got away. Whatever it might be, they find and they recruit all of the people who are known to spread lies, to tell the biggest yarns, and they bring them to this trial in the middle of the night, and they have them bear witness, bear false testimony. And apparently, they were so good at lying that they couldn't even find something that they agreed on. That's what makes it so insane, is that they were seeking false testimony that they might put him to death, but they found none, though many false witnesses came forward. Like, how does that even happen? You would think if people were, good at lying, they would be able to lie about the same thing. I mean, their truth is out of the question here. It's just about bearing false witness. There was many of them that came bearing false witness, and yet there wasn't enough false testimony that they could build a case on, which just exposes how unjust this hearing really is. This is not a real court. This is not a real pursuit of justice. We can see it's corrupt through and through. Now, it is interesting when we think about justice, and we think about the prescriptions in the law that actually were to guard against bearing false testimony. Of course, we know that bearing false witness against your neighbor was prohibited by the law. That's one of the Ten Commandments, Exodus 20, verse 16. We know also the words of Exodus 23. You shall not spread a false report. You shall not join hands with a wicked man to be a malicious witness. Keep far from a false charge, and do not kill the innocent and righteous, for I will not acquit the wicked. There's all of these warnings built into the law about upholding a true standard of justice. You don't lie against your neighbor. You don't join those who want to spread malicious testimony. You surely do not want to kill the innocent and the righteous, because God will hold you accountable for that. And yet all of this is happening exposes the wickedness in their hearts. It exposes that they're evil. Now we know that the law also required that there would be more than one witness. And it did carry a very serious charge against those who would bear false witness. I think we covered this at some point in Matthew, but this is from Deuteronomy 19. A single witness shall not suffice against a person for any crime or any wrong in connection with any offense that he has committed. Only on the evidence of two witnesses or of three witnesses shall a charge be established. So there is a standard of justice here. It's not just taking one person's word for it. It's a plurality. It's more than one witness. And they are to be cross-examined. They are to be evaluated by those making the judgment so that they do not condemn an innocent man. Is their testimony reliable? Is it true? Are they somehow in cahoots with one another? So that is the role of the judge. Now listen to how Deuteronomy warns against bearing false witness. If a malicious witness arises to accuse a person of wrongdoing, then both parties to the dispute shall appear before the Lord, before the priests and the judges who are in office in those days. The judges shall inquire diligently, and if the witness is a false witness and has accused his brother falsely, then you shall do to him as he had meant to do to his brother. So you shall purge the evil from your midst. And the rest shall hear and fear and shall never again commit any such evil among you. Your eye shall not pity. It shall be life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot. So we know in a society like this, and these judges are making these decisions based upon trustworthy plurality of witnesses, they know that if there is a case in which a judgment is made, and that judgment is determined to be false, that witness is determined to be lying, then the judgment that was the punishment for that crime, whatever it might have been, was going to be exacted upon the person bearing the false witness. So when the people of Israel see that happening, they see this person lying about someone else, bearing false witness, and you see them punished for that, that causes the rest of the society to step back and say, whoa, this is a serious deal. I can't just simply accuse one another from some sort of crime without actually having proof. And if I do that falsely and I am found guilty, then I will be put to death or I will be charged, whatever it might be. So all of this just demonstrates that this pursuit of justice is a complete sham. This is a mockery of justice. They are not seeking truth. They are not trying to uphold justice, even though they're looking for a plurality of witnesses. That's what makes it seem so ironic. I mean, irony is just caked throughout this whole entire couple chapters of Matthew. They're coming to a decision looking for false witnesses, and yet they want to have two of them, maybe make it seem like they're really concerned about justice when all they're seeking is false testimony. They're seeking lies. So the judgment then that they come to at the end of the passage should be the same judgment that is enacted upon them. Interesting that metaphor is given in Proverbs 25:18. It says, a man who bears false witness against his neighbor is like a war club or a sword or a sharp arrow. Recalling the fact that these crowds came to arrest Jesus with swords and clubs, here they continue to wage war against him. And yet their war that they're waging against him is not one with physical swords and clubs, at least not yet, but it's their words, it's their false testimony. They're completely opposed to Jesus. So they finally get their breakthrough. The thing that they've needed to condemn him to death. They finally get two witnesses that say the same thing, that bear the same testimony. And finally, there's two witnesses that can agree. So at last, two came forward and said, this man said, I am able to destroy the temple of God and to rebuild it in 3 days. Now here's their false testimony. Now what's interesting about this is that this is very similar to something that Jesus actually said. And they're changing his words, and I'll show you from John. So it is not necessarily that they're coming up with a lie, even though what they're saying distorts what Jesus actually said. But it is interesting that it's so close to the truth that you would almost be like, well, they're actually not coming up with a lie about Jesus. They're coming up with something that he did say that was true. Now let's dig into this a little bit more because it is interesting. So Matthew doesn't record this saying of Jesus, but John does. In the beginning of John's gospel, when Jesus cleansed the temple, the Jews asked him, "What sign do you show us for doing these things?" And Jesus answered them, "Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up." That's John 2, 18 and 19. Now, notice the subtle difference here. What Jesus actually said is, "Destroy this temple," meaning, "You destroy this temple." He is talking about, it's actually in the imperative mood, he's telling them to destroy this temple. A second person plural imperative. So what they're accusing him of saying, though, back in Matthew, is claiming to have the power or the ability to destroy the temple. Now, of course, what they are thinking is that Jesus is claiming to have the ability to destroy the physical temple. And you know that that's what they're thinking because that's what they're thinking in John chapter 2. This is a subtle but important difference. When Jesus said what he did in John, he was not speaking of the temple building, but he was speaking of the temple of his body. Remember, John adds that parenthetical statement. He is speaking about the true tabernacle, the ultimate way in which God dwells among his people, the true place where God and man meet. He's talking about himself. But the people, of course, understood him to be speaking about the physical temple. And that's why they respond with such incredulity. They say, "It's taken 46 years to build this temple. And even at this time, you know that it's not finished yet. It's not finished until 64 AD. There's 30 more years of building taking place here. And they say, "It's taken 46 years to build it. How can you raise it in 3 days? Impossible." But we know Jesus was speaking about his death and resurrection. He's not talking about a construction project. So when Jesus was speaking about his death and resurrection, he's saying clearly saying to them that he's not talking about the physical temple. Now we know that he, of course, did talk about the destruction of the physical temple. We just went through Matthew 24. He makes it very clear that that's what he's talking about in the beginning of that chapter when he tells the disciples that not one stone would be left that would not be thrown down. So he does talk about destroying the temple, but that was not a public statement. That was a statement that was made in private to his disciples when they were on the Mount of Olives together just a couple nights ago. And it's precisely the same accusation that is brought up against Stephen in Acts chapter 6. So they don't seem to be basing their testimony off of those statements because I don't think they were present to hear them. So apparently, though, the change that takes place in the language that they use is that Jesus is claiming the ability to destroy the physical temple of God and to rebuild it in 3 days, when that was not what he was talking about. And he was not talking about his ability to destroy himself. He was talking about the fact that they would destroy him. "You destroy this temple, and I will raise it up." So nevertheless, that is the false testimony. The charge seems to fall flat. The high priest questions him on the charge, trying to get Jesus to respond, and Jesus remains silent. He doesn't say a thing. The first of 3 times Jesus responds to his accusers with silence. We'll see it twice more in chapter 27. And it brings to mind Isaiah 53, right? He was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. Like a lamb that is led to the slaughter, and like a sheep that before its shearers is silent, so he opened not his mouth. And in his silence, as Peter says, he continued entrusting himself to him who judges justly. So Jesus is not here to defend himself or to correct the false witnesses that he's hearing. He seems to be less concerned with these lies that are being spoken about him than he is about carrying out his Father's will. But there is a way for the high priest to elicit a response. Now, this is kind of interesting too. The law provides a warning for a person who is called upon to testify that if they do not bear witness, then they bear their iniquity, they bear their sin. So the way that this would work would be, you know, such and such an event takes place, or some sort of crime, a murder, a car wreck, whatever it might be, and the judges come forth and they ask for witnesses. Did anybody see this happening? Did anybody see this man kill this other man's goat or whatever it might have been back in the day? And if a person did see it, they were obligated to actually bear witness. They were obligated as a part of that community, as a part of that society, they were obligated to actually testify to what they saw. If they did not do so, then they would bear their iniquity. So Leviticus 5:1 says this, if anyone sins in that he hears a public adjuration to testify, and though he is a witness, whether he has seen or come to know the matter, yet does not speak, he shall bear his iniquity. So they are then compelled to testify about something. And that could be the reason behind what the high priest does next, because he seems to simply take the false testimony and just kind of throw it off to the side. That no longer is the focus of the trial. Even though they brought up these accusations, these are not the accusations that they charge against him for blasphemy. What takes place is going to lead to the blasphemy charge. So he says, let's see, in verse 63. Jesus remained silent. The high priest said to him, I adjure you by the living God, tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God. So he's compelling Jesus to bear witness, to testify, compelling him in light of the living God. I call upon the living God for you to bear witness, to answer this question. Now, knowing who Jesus is, this is absolutely absurd. He's calling upon the living God who stands in flesh, incarnate before him, calling upon his name to compel the living God to answer for himself, to defend himself. And knowing everything that Jesus has done, it should be painfully obvious to Caiaphas that he is the Christ, the Son of the living God. Everything that he's done, everything that he's said has demonstrated that he is the Messiah. And yet, Caiaphas, who has been soliciting false witness, wants Jesus to tell the truth. It's just insane to see, again, the irony of all of this happening. As if he would take his word for it, right? If you simply just tell us that you're the Christ, we'll believe you. We will right now, we will bow in submission to you. I'll give you my robes. You can take my place of overruling over the council, the Sanhedrin. I mean, we will submit. We will praise you. As if that would actually change his heart. But he charges Jesus to speak on his behalf, to defend himself. He places Jesus under this type of oath. Tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God. Now this does get at the real issue. Now we know that in their minds they have been bent against Jesus from the very beginning. We know that the true question is, who is Jesus? Who are you really? Tell us clearly, who are you? And if he is not the Messiah, then he's a false Messiah. He's a pretender. But if he is the Messiah, then he is worthy of worship. So the high priest wants to know who Jesus is, but not for the purposes of bowing down to him in humble submission, not to acknowledge him as Lord, not to honor him as king and swear an oath of fealty to him. He wants to know so he can condemn him. He's not looking for a reason to worship, but to destroy, to kill. So he cuts to the chase, not talking about temples or destruction or resurrection, but talking about the Messiah. Are you the Christ, the Son of God? Now it is interesting here too as well that his question is very similar to what we see Peter confess in chapter 16. Remember when Jesus asked Peter, "Who do you say that I am?" And Peter responded with these words, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God. You are the Messiah. You are David's offspring. David's son who would be king forever." Now it's interesting here that, you know, Peter has just been described as not sitting too far off from this trial that's taking place. Now perhaps Matthew wants us to recall Peter's confession and Jesus' subsequent blessing. How did Peter arrive at that conclusion? How did Peter arrive at the fact that he recognized that Jesus was truly the Messiah, the Son of God? Well, it wasn't because flesh and blood revealed it to him. He didn't arrive at that just through a natural process of processing out the facts and of thinking and of using reason and logic. He didn't arrive at it that way. No, it was supernatural. "Blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. I tell you, you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades shall not prevail against it." So if Matthew is hinting at this, connecting these dots for us, the conclusion that Peter had about Jesus, the conclusion that presumably the high priest is seeking, cannot be arrived at by flesh and blood. It must be something supernatural. It must be God the Father himself opening up the eyes of the blind to show them who Jesus truly is. Now, that's kind of a side note, but we'll continue on with the trial. So Jesus, under oath, by the living God, affirms the truth of the high priest's question. "You have said so. You said it. What you said is true." Essentially saying, "Yes, I am." The same response that Jesus gave to Judas back during the Passover meal when Judas asked if he was the one who would betray Jesus. "Is it I, Rabbi? You have said so." So under oath before the living God, Jesus affirms the truth of the high priest's question. But he doesn't stop there. He continues. "I tell you, from now on, you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of power and coming on the clouds of heaven." Now this is what really riles up the feathers. So Jesus echoes Psalm 110. "The Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies your footstool." Daniel 7. Two passages that we've looked at when we've gone through Matthew. Matthew, I think 22, 23. Matthew 24. Jesus declares himself to be the Christ, the Son of the living God. A claim that would be utterly blasphemous if anybody else were to make it. Now, interesting here to see that his first response is to the high priest. "You have said so." He responds directly to the statement of the high priest. But the second sentence is addressed to everyone present, to all who were there, the whole Sanhedrin, whatever false witnesses were still around. The "you" and "I tell you" and "you will see" is plural. He's speaking to all of them. Not just to the high priest, but to all of those who would bring this charge against Jesus for blasphemy. He proclaims to all of them present that they will see him exalted to the place of honor at God's right hand, and the one who approaches the Ancient of Days to receive an everlasting kingdom, a dominion that would last forever. You will all see it. Now, it is interesting enough when we read Psalm 110, the one described seated at God's right hand, David, David's Lord, he addresses him as his Lord. This is the king priest, the one who was the son of David and yet was greater than David, was superior to David. The one who was a priest, but not after Levi. He was a priest according to the order of Melchizedek. He was a priest who had no origin and who had no end of days. A priest who would last forever. And this one priest rules from Zion with his holy golden scepter. The one whose feet will rest on his enemies like a footstool. Whose people will willingly offer themselves to him on the day of his power. He is the judge. And he proclaims himself to be the judge even while his people are falsely accusing him, falsely judging him. Again, irony. Here is the judge of the living and the dead, the judge of all the nations, right? Matthew 25, Son of Man comes and all the nations are gathered before him. Here is the one who is being judged by 70 crooked, wicked, evil people. We've already seen in our study of Matthew 24 that the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven is not a reference to his coming to earth, but it's a coming to the Ancient of Days. He is not approaching earth riding on a cloud. He is approaching the Ancient of Days riding on a cloud, ascending to the Ancient of Days and standing before him to receive his kingdom, his dominion, his eternal reign. So when they say this language that's being used here, you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of power, and coming on the clouds of heaven, he's saying that they will all recognize that Jesus is truly the one who is seated at God's right hand and truly the Messiah who receives the kingdom from the Ancient of Days. Now, what he pronounced to his disciples in Matthew 24 is that the judgment of Jerusalem would be proof of his identity as the Son of Man. Right? That would be when his words as the great final prophet of God would come true, and that he would be vindicated against the people who cried out for his blood. So what we're seeing here is not an eschatological statement about some future coming of Christ on the clouds of heaven to earth, to which it would be impossible for these men to see because they are all dead. But it's a recognition that he would be the true Messiah. However veiled it was to them at the time, we see clearly now that Jesus has been exalted and he has sat down at God's right hand, and he continues to rule over the entire heavens and earth. But this is what causes the high priest to de-priest himself, as someone said. He tears his robes and said, "He has uttered blasphemy. What further witnesses do we need?" Now, typically in that culture, you would see, not necessarily under a case of blasphemy, and there's probably some examples of that, but when there has been some sort of judgment or when a people have been brought to repentance, they usually cover themselves in sackcloth and ashes. There's a period of lament, a period of mourning over their sin. Tearing the clothes would probably be associated with that. But for a high priest to tear his robes would have demonstrated that he is no longer a high priest. If you're doing the Bible reading plan and you read through the importance of the high priest's robes, this was how he was going to go into the Holy of Holies to represent the people. Right? He is wearing the linen ephod, and he is wearing the breastplate of something, or righteousness, or something like that, with all of the stones of the people on his chest as he walks into the Holy of Holies, representing his people, bringing atonement for sin. And this high priest just tears his robes. He just rips them apart. Which is probably a little bit over the top. If he really understood what he was doing. Instead of tearing his robes off and recognizing his sinfulness before the Messiah, he tears his robes in objection to what the Messiah has just claimed. The objection to what the Messiah has just said. So Jesus is saying that his true identity is going to be made known to his people. These people are going to witness it. Not in the way that Peter did. Not in the way that brought about a true conversion of heart. Not in the way that showed the supernatural working of the Father. But they would witness it because they would experience it when they are made a footstool for his feet. When they are brought low by the judge who wields the scepter from Zion. So nevertheless, the verdict is now in. Guilty of blasphemy. Punishable by death. That is the judgment. And furthermore, they continue to mock him. Leviticus 24:16, whoever blasphemes the name of the Lord shall surely be put to death. They recognize his claim. It's not a question of what he's saying. You know, did he really say that? Did he really mean that? Could he possibly be saying what he thinks he's saying? They recognize his claim that he truly is this character, right? This messianic figure. He truly is that person. Whoever blasphemes the name of the Lord shall surely be put to death, and all the congregation shall stone him. The sojourner as well as the native, when he blasphemes the name, shall be put to death. So here he is, Jesus. The last word the Father has spoken to his people, the appointed heir of all things, David's son and yet David's Lord, the radiance of the glory of God, the exact imprint of his nature, the one who upholds the universe by his powerful word, the one who made purification for sins and sat down at the right hand of the majesty of high, the Son of God. Here he is before his people. And what do? They condemn him. They spit in his face. They strike him. They slap him. They mock him. And what did he do? He continued entrusting himself to the one who judges justly, knowing that his vindication is right around the corner. What did he do? He laid down his life for the scattered sheep. What did he do? He drank the cup filled with the Father's wrath. What did he do? He gave his life as a ransom for many. He gave his body and he poured out his blood for the forgiveness of our sins. That truly is our King. Let's pray.